This past week saw Israelis go to the polls for now the second time this year to vote for which political party would lead them, just as it happened back in April. The election last week failed to give current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu or his main challenger, Benny Gantz, the majority that they needed. So, what happens now? How do Israelis see both of these people who want to lead them? How will who eventually wins impact not just domestic but foreign policy, especially between Israel and the U.S.? Joining us now to discuss this and more from Israel is the co-founder and executive editor of the Media Line, Michael Friedson. How are you today, sir?
Good, thank you.
TheMediaLine.org is where you can read about what's going on with this. If you're into politics, fascinating story, and other things in the Middle East. As we speak at this moment, what's the current situation regarding the elections from this past week? How do things stand?
Well, it's going to take about 2 weeks to sort this stuff out. Israel's system of government is different than back in the States. In the States, you think you vote for somebody. There's one guy you like, one guy you hate. You vote. The guy you like wins. You think you're not going to see the other guy for a couple years. That doesn't happen here. The guy that has been fighting with the other guy for all these months could end up the next morning after the election sitting in the same government as a colleague on the same level in the cabinet. It's a strange system from that standpoint, but that's kind of where we are now. No Israeli wants to see a third election in 1 year. Two elections in 5 months is really stressing out the country as it is. They want to get on with the business of running it. So they got to get the two men who head the parties with the most votes. They have to figure out a way to combine them, or somehow they have to reach 61 out of 120 seats in the parliament in order to get moving. And right now it's good old-fashioned horse trading.
Yeah.
They're negotiating, and they're really intense in negotiations. Each party is saying to the guy who will lead the party, to lead the coalition, I'll come to your party under certain circumstances. And they list, they want cash, they want their programs funded, they want seats on committees, they want deputy ministerial positions, and it goes on and on like that. And it'll take fully 2 weeks before they know anything. The president, which is largely a ceremonial position, but he's actually got to work during election time, he's going to be using the bully pulpit and twisting arms and trying to get this thing done. The thing is, for the Israelis, it's not a light consideration that Netanyahu is the most experienced prime minister in their history. He's been prime minister longer than even David Ben-Gurion, the founding prime minister. And the other guy, Benny Gantz, is former Army chief of staff, but he's never legislated a day in his life. He's completely novice when it comes to politics. So there are those who say he should take the second. I'm getting ahead of myself. They're talking about a unity government. A unity government, the two parties, the two blocks would merge. That would give them enough seats to go on with the order of business of governing. And probably the two men who head the parties would split the prime ministership. So there'd be 2 years or 2.5 years of one guy, and then he steps down, and 2.5 years of the other guy. And all these things have to be worked out, and it's quite a to-do, but that's the direction it's moving, the unity government.
Well, having said that, if Gantz has a goal to be a politician or a leader of at some level of Israel, as opposed to a chief of staff of the army or a novice, wouldn't this, in the long term, if not necessarily immediately, but in the long term, get Gantz to the place where he eventually wants to be?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a big, huge leap. Very rarely does a person begin at the absolute level zero and hit the home run right away and become the prime minister of the country. It's unusual, but it could theoretically happen.
It does create an interesting situation, if I'm understanding right. Just say that the Likud and Blue and White Party form their coalition government. Based on the number of seats that the Arab parties wound up getting in the election, with a huge Arab-Israeli turnout, that would give the Arab parties access to all the perks of being the minority party, so to speak, security briefings, and issues such as that.
I was just going to bring that up. I'm kind of amazed that that story, which I think is a huge story, as big as the election itself, and it hasn't really been getting coverage that it deserves. And you described it perfectly. Under the system, if the first two parties merge and there's a coalition government, it was the Arab-Israeli parties in one block called the Joint List that got the third highest amount of seats in the Knesset, the parliament. That means that, as you said, they will be the official head of opposition, and the head of opposition will be the leader of that party, who, of course, is an Israeli Arab. He will be privy to security briefings regularly. The parties as a bloc will be available, will be entitled to security briefing seats on committees as sensitive as the Intelligence Committee, Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, and the list goes on. Some people, it's hard for us in the States to realize that this doesn't have to have racist overtones, but the fact that the Israeli Arabs who sit in the parliament are exempt from swearing an oath of office to the country. I don't think there's another situation in any democracy in the world today where every member of the legislature or parliament doesn't swear an oath of office to the country. So what many Israelis say is that we don't mind them sitting in the Knesset, but the fact that they don't swear an oath of loyalty to the country, and in fact many of them participate in distinctly anti-Israel demonstrations and events during the course of the years, that's inappropriate for even for a democracy. So that is going to blow up to be even a bigger story than it is today. But just as it is today, when you think of people comparing Israel to South Africa and talk about apartheid, certainly in an apartheid situation, if there was one, you wouldn't have the Arab community voting, taking control, being the third populist party, and being privy to all the intelligence information that they can muster.
With Michael Friedson, who is the co-founder and executive editor of The Media Line. TheMediaLine.org is their website, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. And the Arab voting turnout, by the way, for the second election this past week went from the 40 percentile to, I think it was almost 61-62%. How much of that was the created the situation now? Did the Likud party lose, or did the influx of Arab voters that came out the second time, almost a, you know, better than 20% increase in the voter turnout among Arab Israelis, did it just put more voters in the pool that wound up shorting Likud without them really losing any support on their side?
Well, what Netanyahu was screaming at his followers all along was saying, look, it's not just voting, because if you don't vote for Likud and Likud doesn't become the party with the greatest number of seats, nothing matters. It's going to lose. That's pretty much what happened. You know, we talk about the debates and the complaints that the networks have that they can't fit so many candidates on stage and there's so many people. Imagine in Israel, if they had to do those kind of debates, there were 29 parties standing for election this time. 29 parties. So chew on that one.
That would be not just a two-night event. That would be what we used to call in the States a week-long miniseries.
There you go. Absolutely.
Is this proof, too, that maybe this is maybe why Trump and Netanyahu have picked up such a strong camaraderie? They both have a lot of people who really don't like them personally, but as far as who's right for the job, is that how Netanyahu survived this long?
That's exactly right. You know, a couple of elections ago, we were actually the only shop in town that said Netanyahu was going to win. The press was really going overboard and saying that this time he's going to get beat. But there were two questions that they always ask in polling, and the first one's not important. The second one is telling. The first one is who are you going to vote for? Everybody lies. It doesn't matter. Don't go there. But the second question, who do you feel is most capable of having the finger on the button, that's the thing that they do quietly in the secrecy of the voting booth. It's it's health and wealth. It's my family's safety. It's my own safety. It's the recognition that there are 140,000 missiles aimed at it from Hezbollah in southern Lebanon alone, and all these things pile up. So Netanyahu was at a disadvantage because there were so many splinter parties that siphoned off the same vote pool that he was after. We're limited in the number of parties, the number of options the voter had. Many of the small right-wing parties would have been virtually automatically in the Netanyahu column, and he probably would have handily won the race again. But he was at a disadvantage because he is the one who was losing the votes when the other parties were siphoning them off.
This, for you listening, is one of those very interesting stories if you're certainly into politics, or certainly if you're wondering, well, what's going to happen in the world? One of the major players in world events is Israel, both on the giving and receiving side of the story. So, unfortunately, too much of the American media is not covering this in the aspects that others are, one of those being the Media Line. TheMediaLine.org is one of the websites you should be marking as a favorite, because they're going to give it to you straight with insight that will educate you and not just try to play favorites or curry with who they think is going to get something for them. Again, it's TheMediaLine.org. We've been talking with their co-founder and executive editor, Michael Fried. So, Michael, thanks for your insight. As always, you get to the truth and you help us learn better about why we should care. Thanks for being here today.
It's a pleasure, and thank you for your kind words.